I think it's started to focus a lot more on work as a work as being an important part of somebody's life, as one's self-image, work as being linked to health, work as being linked to well-being, sort of more of a positive view of work. So I think across time, work has come to be viewed as really something that's very important, like that there's a pleasure in work, that if you have a job you love, it's a really good thing to be able to get up and go to work in the morning. But it's a shame that that's not true for everybody.
Hi there, and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Marie Wong at the University of Michigan Dearborn about industrial organizational psychology.
Yeah, so industrial organizational psychology, or IO psych for short, is the field of psychology that deals with people's behavior in work environments and sort of what characteristics are going to lead to success in that environment.
IO psych is one of the lesser known fields of psychology, but the field has been growing rapidly since about the time of World War I. So during World War I, American Lieutenant Clarence S. Yoakum, as chief psychologist, was tasked with administering tests to his camp. And these tests measured things like literacy, mechanical ability, and mental age, which we know now as IQ. These tests were meant to gauge the cognitive abilities of his men and assign roles according to their results. Yoakum first tested the medical officers and found that those who performed better on cognitive tests also did better work. And the generals really liked this information, so he tested the whole camp and future recruits. Nowadays, we think about a wide range of skills outside of IQ and in a wide range of settings outside of the military. But Yoakum helped set the foundation for IO psych by asking how different strengths make people suited for different roles.
Yeah, and that early focus carried on into really all of IO psychology of measurement and figuring out characteristics. One way that Dr. Wong puts it is that psychologists at the time were looking for a periodic table of human attributes, just like chemists at the time were developing the periodic table of the elements. They wanted to find a way that they could classify every sort of personality trait or characteristic and sort of class people according to those to figure out where they might fit best in an occupational setting. So a lot of early research in sort of trying to classify all possible human traits and attributes started by looking at dictionaries of all things. And psychologists would go through a dictionary and go through a process called qualitative coding, where they have a list of criteria, and if a word meets this criteria, it's included in their study, and then they sort of try to categorize them. So a lot of these early personality inventories would have 40, 50, or even 60 different traits on them, just because it was every personality trait that a psychologist could find in a dictionary, which is a lot of traits. But as time went on, more complex statistics were developed called factor analysis that allowed psychologists to figure out, okay, what factors here can we derive from all of these different things? So of these 60 characteristics, can we sort of form them into maybe 5 traits that all vary together?
Nice and kind someone is.
Exactly, yeah. So what those statistics allowed people to do was to essentially develop the big 5, which is we can take all of these different things and form them into a model of 5 factors, which are neuroticism, extroversion, openness to experience, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. And what this looks like in terms of the dictionary model is that each of the big 5 have subscales of different traits that fit into them. So agreeableness, for example, would include things like trust, straightforwardness, altruism, compliance, modesty, and tender-mindedness. Whereas conscientiousness might include competence, order, dutifulness, achievement striving, self-discipline, and deliberation. And that sort of helps you get an idea of what traits are included in these larger factors. In an IO setting, what this looks like is people will test for these personality traits when assigning people to different roles within a company, maybe, or maybe even when hiring.
Right. So you want your accountant to be high in conscientiousness.
Definitely. But as one of Dr. Wong's studies showed, too much conscientiousness can be a bad thing.
What?
Yeah. because it turns out when you put a bunch of very highly conscientious people in a group, they get nothing done.
Yeah, I can attest to that.
Yeah, because everyone is so focused on making sure that all of the rules are followed to a T, and that every I is dotted, every T is crossed, that you never actually get to the point where you do anything. Which is why another good characteristic to have in a company, aside from conscientiousness, is agreeableness. Sort of the ability to get along with each other, right? And some combination of those can make a group really effective.
Something else that comes to mind when we think about compatibility with certain careers is Holland's career theory. And this theory states that we prefer some activities over others. So because we prefer these activities, we engage with them more than other ones. And because we engage with them more, practice makes perfect, so we have higher competency in those areas. This theory is used as the basis for the Holland Code Assessment. And the Holland Code Assessment is used to gauge your strongest three interests across six different categories.
So the six categories that the Holland Code Assessment assesses are realistic, investigative, artistic, social, enterprising, and conventional tasks. So these come together into an acronym, RIASEC. So to get a little bit of an idea of what each of these means, maybe we'll go through what Maddie and I got when we took this assessment. So your Holland Code is your first three interests in order. So Maddie has SAI, and Maddie, do you want to tell us a bit about your Holland Code interests?
Yeah, so I mean, looking at it now, I probably could have told you this myself, but so I'm SAI, social, artistic, and investigative. And careers that use these traits are often involved in things like therapy and education. So this makes sense, right? Because social, working directly with people, artistic, getting to use your creativity, maybe in designing lesson plans or treatment plans, and investigative, having that love of learning new things.
Definitely. And there are websites, too, where you can go and look up Holland Codes and their frequency within different, and association with different careers. So when I took the test, I got ISC, investigative, social, and conventional. And careers using these traits are often involved with medicine and research fields. So that makes sense, because we have investigative, which is all about asking questions, seeking to learn new things. We have social, which is working with people, right? So working with patients or working with research subjects. And conventional, which is sort of about maintaining the rules, the regulations, the standards, bringing data into what you do with your work, so like in a research career. And then the two letters that we didn't touch on are realistic, imagine that, and enterprising. So realistic people tend to be assertive and competitive, looking for activities that require skill and strength. So think something like a neurosurgeon or a car mechanic. And then enterprising people are able to persuade and really talk well with others. So think like politicians or lawyers.
Right, entrepreneurs maybe.
Yeah. So the Big Five and the Holland Code Assessment are two different ways that industrial organizational psychology has brought itself into measuring personality and then applying that to work. So in the last several decades, as we'll talk about in the interview, really since that initial formation of the field with World War I and with assessment, we've moved past measurement into other fields with industrial organizational psychology. And some of these are an application of the measurement focus, whereas others aren't related at all. So job selection and placement. So when you're hiring someone, selection, the question of do you want to hire them, and placement, which position and which team are you going to place them in? And this is where a lot of that compatibility comes in. Training and development. So a lot of that too can come back to measurement, in that you need to know what strengths do your employees have and how can you work with them on the areas where they need more work. Performance management. So IO Psych looks at how to evaluate employee performance and how to improve it, how to incentivize people to do better, right? And that comes into organizational development as another goal. So working on developing the organization to be a good place for employees and also a good place as far as being productive and efficient. Organizational behavior. So looking at, in a sort of descriptive fashion, how people behave within organizations. And then being able to take that back to the very applied focus of making those organizations into better places. And organizational behavior, too, is a bit of an interesting field because it gets interdisciplinary, too. It extends beyond psychology into some other fields. And all of this really comes back to, especially in recent years, trying to make the workplace a more fair and a better environment in which to be. And a lot of industrial organizational psych research is being applied now as well, as we're making a major shift to remote work due to the coronavirus. Looking at what do people need to be successful in an environment when they don't have a physical location to go into for work? What sorts of things do employees need so that they don't get fatigued by online conferencing? How can teams work together when they're not seeing each other? These are questions that industrial organizational psychologists are asking and researching right now, and have in the past, to find ways to make the best of the work environment that we have.
We're going to talk about all of this and all of the ways that IO psychologists make the workplace a better place to be with Dr. Marie Wong.
All right, so we are here today at the University of Michigan Dearborn with Dr. Wong. Good morning, Dr. Wong.
Good morning.
We're here to talk with you again about industrial organizational psychology. So it's been a few months since we spoke last. Could you give us a brief summary of your background and education?
Sure. I attended Miami University, which is in Oxford, Ohio. It's no palm trees, just a lot of cows. When I was there, I loved my psychology courses. And especially I liked applied courses. So I took a lot of psychology courses, and I ended up taking some courses in the College of Business also. And then all of a sudden I'm like thinking, oh, industrial psychology might be for me. So I ended up going to Ohio State, and I got a master's there and a PhD. So I am a Buckeye. And I do have to tell you, I might have said this in the last podcast. I can't remember, so hopefully I don't repeat too much. But at the time, the psychology offices were in Ohio Stadium, which is weird, like having your offices in the football stadium. But that's where I met my husband. So I have to be an Ohio State fan. Although I have four kids and two of them are Wolverines. So we really? Have kind of a mixed household. So I always tell them, like, I'm a Buckeye every day of the month except the last day of the month when I'm a Wolverine because that's payday. So that paycheck, that direct deposit, I'm like, oh, look, I'm rich. And then I know for about 5 minutes I'm rich and then it all goes back out.
What do you see as the goal of industrial organizational psychology?
So industrial psychology, well, let me sort of explain the field in general, just a basic in case you're not familiar with it. It's not covered a lot in introductory psychology books. It tends to be either in an appendix or it's like a little tiny section within another chapter. So a lot of students come in, they're like, well, what is industrial organizational psychology? And I know, like, sometimes when you're at parties, like, people will ask you, like, what do you do? And if I say I'm an industrial organizational psychologist, they just like look at me like, what? And then people have said to me, like, industrial, like giant size. I'm like, no. And other people have said, well, you must be really organized. And that's not what it is. What we're doing is we're taking psychological principles and we're applying them to the workplace. So we're trying to make the workplace better. And there's two, actually, if you're wondering why there's the industrial and the organizational, the industrial part is a measurement. And if you go back to the history of psychology, the early psychologists tried to measure everything. Psychology actually began with trying to measure human attributes and trying to understand how to measure things. And it really tried to follow the natural sciences like chemistry and biology, because psychology was trying to be more scientific. So one of the things, the idea was, well, in chemistry, we have this periodic table of the elements. Well, in psychology, the thought was, well, maybe we can sort of develop something similar with regard to like human characteristics. And so that was sort of the beginnings of psychology, but industrial psychology grew out of that, at least part of it did. And that portion was trying to measure human knowledge, skills, and abilities, and other things. So you'll hear me say KSAOs. That stands for knowledge, skills, abilities, and other characteristics. So if you've ever gone to apply for a job and you've been given a selection test, that might be something that was done by an industrial psychologist, where we're trying to measure your characteristics and then match them to the job requirements. So that's sort of the industrial side. It's very heavily focused on measurement. Then there's the organizational side that's very much focused on the social aspects of work, that we work with other people, that we need to be motivated, that we, you know, if you want to be a good leader, what characteristics are important in good leaders, what behaviors. So that whole social part is also a part of work. So that's where we get the industrial and the organizational. Industrial is the measurement, organizational is the social part. So the purpose, in my view, of the field is really to take people and try to match them with jobs. That's one purpose, like to make sure that people are in jobs that fit with them. So if I know your knowledge, skills, and abilities, and your personality to some degree, maybe I can help figure out what would be the best job for you. And what would be the best job for the company, too, in terms of you being productive and performing well. But also, like, how can I get a work group where people work well together? How can I get a leader who is successful as a leader? So it's very practical, the field.
How does the knowledge that we gain about the mind from IO psychology differ from, like, personality or social psychology?
So I mentioned already about industrial psychology, and I did mention that it's close to social psychology, that there's some overlap there. It is different in that it's very, very applied. So a lot of what we're taking, we take some social psychology principles, but then we apply them. In terms of personality, we actually use something called the Big Five, or the five-factor model, and we use that in the workplace, and I'll tell you about that in just a second, because I think that's an interesting thing that we can relate to work. But generally, the fields don't overlap very much. So we might take some things from some scales or measures that personality theorists have developed, but we're not really doing anything with personality theory. So for example, with the five-factor model, there are a couple of traits that really translate well into the workplace. So if I have an employee who's conscientious and agreeable, that tends to be a really good combination, right? So if I'm hiring somebody, I might want to look and figure out what's their level of conscientiousness, what's their level of agreeableness. But it's not as simple as it seems, though, because you actually, there's sort of a sweet spot, right? So you can have it where somebody is almost, you want a certain level of agreeableness. And I should explain that people who are agreeable tend to be kind and sympathetic and warm and cooperative and considerate. They sound like great coworkers, right? Which, and it's good, you want a certain level. If somebody's disagreeable, they're going to be miserable to work with. But sometimes if they're too agreeable, that can be a problem too. Because what if I come in and I'm a boss, a supervisor, and I need to get people to, you know, follow the rules and do certain things. But if I'm so agreeable, how can I do that without, you know, sort of having a lot of conflict with my natural personality? Another thought with agreeableness is sometimes purposely, we need a little bit of conflict. Conflict isn't bad in work, but you have to be very careful in terms of how it's managed. So somebody who is very, very agreeable, like really high on that scale, might have difficulties with some conflict. Because when people are passionate about what they're doing, and if they have strong ideas, sometimes you will get conflict. And a lot of times our advice is like to manage it. And of course, you have to be very respectful of each other, but it's not like you can erase it. And so that's the thing where personality, that sort of middle level, is kind of good. And same with conscientiousness, actually. If somebody is, you want people who are conscientious, of course, because those are people who are punctual, who are self-disciplined, who they go and they do the job, you know, they plan things out. So they sound like great employees. Obviously, you wouldn't want someone who was low in conscientiousness. But you can get people who were so high in conscientiousness that they're rigid, that they become so rule-obsessed that it doesn't even make sense. So again, like when you think about personality and personality traits, and I think this is probably true of many human characteristics, there's sort of like a middle level that's very good, you know, but if you get to the extremes, that's sometimes where the problems can occur.
So what's your personal goal as a psychologist?
So I'm a really practical person. I like to do research that applies directly to people's workplaces or people's work lives. So for example, when I'm teaching a course, one of the things I often do is I'll take the content that I'm teaching and I'll talk about directly how students can use this in the workplace. I also, when I'm doing research, I always have a section in my papers where I talk about how managers, how we call them practitioners, how they could apply the research. So I think my answer would be, my goal is I want to do research that's practical that people can use.
Could you give us an overview of the kinds of questions you've asked since completing your graduate education?
Sure. So one thing I want to do is, let me sort of give you, you're talking about research questions, right? So let me sort of explain like how the research process, like how it works at different schools, because then I think it'll be a little clearer like why mine is so eclectic. So basically I have research that is very, very eclectic, meaning it covers a lot of different areas. I feel like I have the freedom to do that because we are like a teaching research institution. If I were at an institution where research, there are some universities that they're very hardcore research and the faculty have a lot of pressure to publish a lot and to publish in high quality journals. In those situations, they have to be very, very focused because if you need to publish a lot and you need to publish in these good journals, you have to know a small area very, very well. So there's sort of that model, and that's important because that really pushes our knowledge forward. When you think about knowledge and how we get knowledge, that these faculty are working on, these researchers are working on very, very basic knowledge and sort of pushing it forward. So they're very important to the field. But there also is an importance of taking that and applying it or looking for little problems, little gaps in the areas. So the way I sort of think about it is almost like if you were building a structure, and the faculty, the researchers who were doing the very, very basic stuff, they're sort of building the bricks. And so it'd be like, here's a brick, and you're going to work on this brick, and that's the brick you're going to work on for the rest of your career. This is your brick. And I don't like that. That's just not me. Like, I'm so like, I need to flip from brick to brick. I want to look and see where the seams are at the bricks. So that's where I feel like my research has been much more bouncing around. Now, the downside is you don't become as much of an expert in an area. And you also can't publish as much because it takes a long time to read the literature and get involved in it. But I think it works really well for teaching because then when you're teaching a class, there are so many different areas where you've done research and you can say, I did it. And it works for advising students because then there are so many things, there are a lot of options for students. So I guess I just wanted to explain that because I think students sometimes don't understand that the kind of institution where somebody's doing research and where they're going to school has an impact on sort of like the strategy or the approach the professor might have. And one of the reasons I really like being at a teaching research place is there's a lot of freedom. You want to keep your research active, and it can be a struggle trying to balance. I'll talk about that later, but it can be a struggle trying to balance all the duties. But I do like the fact that my research can be eclectic. So I'm sorry it took me so long to get to the point, but so let me explain like some of the areas I've done research. One of them is employee orientation. So this was actually, my dissertation was based on this. And we were trying to figure out, if orientation programs could reduce early turnover. Because it's very stressful to be a new employee. And we were finding that in some jobs, there was turnover very, very early on. And turnover means when people quit. So people would quit very, very early on. And so the idea was, what if we had like a coping orientation and we told people how to deal with some of the daily stress they would face? Would that help? So that was one of the studies that I've done. Another area of research where I've worked on is performance evaluation and feedback. What are the mechanisms that affect feedback inflation? So feedback inflation means that we tend to be overly positive when we give people feedback. We don't like to say negative things to them. So we sometimes, even if somebody's having a little bit of a performance issue, sometimes we don't always tell them, or if they're an average performer, maybe we tell them, you're above average, even if they're not. The problem with this is, how do people get better then? Look, if I can't sit there and tell you exactly what's going on with your performance and give you an honest answer, How do I help you to improve then? So that's sort of the tricky part. And so people who've done research in this area for a long time have tried to figure out, like, how can we get people to be as accurate as possible when they evaluate? But then the other side of it is, how can we also give feedback to people about their performance that they're going to be likely to accept? So I've done some research in that area too. Another area I've done research is in rejection letters. And this is such a sort of like mundane, like everyday topic that nobody's like, you're not going to probably do a giant research program on rejection letters. But it occurred to me that this is important, that if you're getting rejected from a company, what's the best way for them to do it? Because when you think about it, if hundreds of people are applying for a job and a company's rejecting them, let's say it's Ford Motor Company, if they're rejecting hundreds of people, those are potential customers, right? So if I apply for a job and you never even take the time to properly reject me, maybe I'm not going to buy your cars anymore. So that's something I think large corporations have to think about. And also that maybe you want me to reapply sometime. Maybe it's not that I'm a bad applicant. Maybe you just don't have a spot for me right now, but you would like me to reapply. So you don't want to slam the door. You want to keep good relationships. So how do you do that but also reject somebody? I've done some research on that. Two more areas. I've done a bit of research on resumes, and I'll talk about that a little more later on, so I won't talk about that too much right now. But what I'm really interested in is balancing self-promotion and ingratiation, and how, like, to what extent self-promotion involves showing you're competent. Ingratiation is used to increase your likability. So what's the right balance of that for a resume or a cover letter? So that's what I've been researching. And then finally, the last thing, this is my most recent thing I've been working on, are psychological contracts. A psychological contract is sort of this, it's in the employee's head. So it's not an official contract between the employer and the employer and the employee. What it is, it's a contract in the employee's head regarding obligations. So what do I owe my employer and what does my employer owe me? So I'm working with some people in the College of Business, and we're looking at how these develop. So we had interns, and we sort of tracked their development of these as they went through internships. So to summarize, I have had a lot of different research projects that include employee orientation, performance evaluation and feedback, rejection letters, resumes, and psychological contracts. So you can see, like, I have not just focused on one brick. I've been all over the place.
That is so interesting, like, especially about the rejection letters. I never would have thought about how you maintain those relationships.
All right. So what research project of yours are you most proud of?
So one, this is a recent one. I did a project on resumes and cover letters. And the reason I really like this particular project is because it mixes two different research methods that often aren't mixed together. It basically was a content analysis. It was sort of qualitative, and then it was an experiment. So what I was doing is, and I had a couple students help me with this, and I worked on this with Professor McCausland. So it was just a really fun project. What I did was I asked if I could get resumes and cover letters for people who were applying to actual positions. So these were actual resumes and cover letters. They weren't like fake ones. These are ones people actually were using when they were applying for six different positions. And they were sort of like redacted. Like we had all the identifying information blacked out. So we couldn't tell who it was, but we could tell what people were saying and what their, things like their education level and where they had worked and that sort of thing. So we ended up we did a coding scheme for our students, and we had them code the content of the resumes and the cover letters. And what we did was we ended up developing what's called a taxonomy. So a taxonomy is a classification scheme. And we had a taxonomy of types of self-promotion and types of ingratiation. And so self-promotion, the goal is to show that you have the credentials, that you're competent. So self-promotion might include something like talking about how you contributed a great deal to a project, or even talking about your skills, saying, I'm very organized, or I'm a very good team worker. You know, that could be some of the self-promotion. Ingratiation is more, as I mentioned before, linked with likability. So ingratiation could include things like this is a wonderful institution or a wonderful organization. Or it could include things like thanking the person who's reading your materials. It could include trying to be similar in a way to the person who you think is reading your resume and your cover letter. So there are these ways that people were using ingratiation in the resumes and cover letters, particularly the cover letters, that was interesting. So we developed the taxonomy, again, which is a coding scheme. And in this case, it was for types of self-promotion and types of ingratiation. So that was part one of the study. Part two, we then took those elements and we did an experiment where we manipulated different levels of these elements in actual resumes and cover letters. And then we had people who had experience evaluating job applicants look at these resumes and cover letters and evaluate them. And so that way we were able to figure out what's a good balance. And that's exactly what we found out, that the key thing is, as I mentioned this before, sort of with agreeableness and conscientiousness, again, there's sort of a theme going on with me today, but this idea that there's sort of this like sweet spot that you want to show you're competent, but you don't want to seem like your ego is like huge, right? Because the thing that happens is the more you focus on your competence, your likability can go down. So ingratiation was increasing your likability. So the best case scenario was when people were using both together. If it was only one or only the other, it wasn't great. And sort of something I found in other studies, this is particularly tricky for women because gender roles are sometimes inconsistent. The female gender role is inconsistent with self-promotion. So women are sort of taught to be team players, to, you know, not brag about themselves. And I've done some research where if we look at what males are saying and what females are saying, and if it's identical, we find that when women self-promote highly, they are sort of punished for it, men are not. So it's a very tricky thing for a woman then, because you're like, well, I'm trying to self-promote to show I'm competent, but I also have to worry because the more I self-promote, the less likable I'm becoming. And people want to hire people who are likable. So it's this real conundrum. So I guess the answer is you got to do both. Like, you have to self-promote, but do it. I mean, and it's not really fair that even having to think about this, but this is an issue that you have to be careful of. So what I would tell people, and I would tell this to everybody, male and female, absolutely come in and be self-confident. If you're in an interview, resume, whatever it is, be self-confident, show your skills, talk about your skills, and also try to make sure that you're coming across as someone who's going to be very likable, someone who's going to be good to work with.
Very cool. Could you tell us a bit about the research that you're working on now?
Sure. So I'm doing research on psychological contracts. I mentioned that a little bit earlier, where what we're doing is we're looking at whether employees feel that psychological contracts are met or not. In particular, these are interns that we've been working with because we wanted to watch and see how they developed. So we got interns before they started an internship, and we asked them what they thought the organization owed them and what they owed the organization. Then we got them at the end of the internship and asked them the same questions. And then we also asked them questions about whether or not they thought that their obligations had been met. Had the company actually met the obligations toward them? And so that's a study we're working on now. It's going through the publication process, which is a long process. So we'll see what happens with that. But the reason why this matters, you might be thinking, the reason psychological contracts are important is if they're violated, it causes a lot of unhappiness for the employee. It can result in them being less satisfied. They're less likely to engage in citizenship behaviors. If you're familiar with OCBs, or those are organizational citizenship behaviors, these are things that people do that they don't have to do, but that help the company a great deal. So doing the extras, those are very important to a company doing well. But the key is you need people to be willing to do them. And if people feel that their psychological contract has been violated, they're going to be much less likely to engage in those OCBs. They're not going to go above and beyond. They're going to do the bare minimum. So that's my study on that I'm working on right now.
What does a day in the life of Dr. Wong look like?
So my job is a blast. I mean, I really like coming to work. It's a lot of fun. I feel challenged. One of the things, so I have to confess, and you're gonna gasp because this is like before you were even born probably, but I started here in 1992. Are you gasping? They quietly gasped. So you couldn't hear it, but they did. So I've been here since 1992, which is a long time. But my work still hasn't gotten old to me. So I've been doing this, if I'm doing the math right, what is it, 20? Is that 28 years? So the thing about academic jobs, and this is something that really drew me to my profession, is they have a lot of potential to flex and to change. You know, your work, it doesn't always seem like the same job across the years. It's not like you're doing the same thing over and over and over again. There are three major areas in our work. It's teaching, which is probably obvious, right? And research, but there's also a service component where what we're doing in service is we're doing work that involves trying to help the university reach its goals. So, you know, working on being on committees, you know, being concerned with the health of the university, making sure the curriculum's good, evaluating if you know, our programs are good. So there are a lot of things involved in running a university, and faculty take a large role in that. So that's what we mean by service. So again, there's teaching, research, and service. And at different points in life or in your career, you can sort of focus some on some and at other points on others. And so that's what I think has made work really, really interesting, because at some points I'm really focusing a lot on teaching and I'm redoing my classes and I'm so excited about that. Other times I'm more into my research and I'm like, got some project going that I love. And other times, kind of like now, I'm really focused on doing a ton of service, which I'm like, I might be doing too much. I think the hardest part is just trying to balance it all, which that's always the hardest part, isn't it?
What part of your day is most fun?
I think working with students. Students always, like, what I love is if I have a really good class. Like, once in a while, you'll go in and you'll teach, and you're like, they're just getting it. Like, you know, you'll be like, I'm just killing it. They're getting it. And sometimes they even laugh. I'm like, and I'm even funny. So that doesn't happen very often. But, you know, but you get those days, and I'm like, wow, that was really fun. So I would say students are, like, by far, hands down, the most fun part of my day. Except for when I give back an exam and then they just all look at me. I always get the, Dr. Wong, I thought you were so nice. And I'm like, I am nice, but I give hard exams.
How has your relationship to work-life balance changed throughout your career?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think one of the reasons I chose academia, I fell in love with learning. I mean, the minute I got to undergraduate, I was like, I love this. And I clearly just never left a university because I just liked it so much. But one other reason I chose it was because it offers a very flexible lifestyle. You're very, very busy, but I can do a lot of work at home. So if you notice faculty work from all over the place, right, you might be like, well, they're not here, but usually they're working somewhere. So that to me was huge, just being able to work at different times in different places where, and I have four children, so, and they're older now. So, but when they were younger, sometimes I feel like it was just a blur. I don't know. So somehow everything got done, but I'll tell you about my kids now. So one of them, has already graduated. So he graduated from U of M. He was at Ross and he's done. So he's working in an accounting firm in the area. So I get to see him once in a while. I have one at Eastern Michigan University. I have one at Brown University, and I have my high school senior is going to go to U of M in the fall. So I have a crew, right? So it definitely was important for me to be able to have some flexibility and at different points in time. And when my kids were younger, I will say I focused a lot more teaching work. I taught, and teaching was really my focus. It was harder to get my research done because it just was hard with the kids and all the things going on. But then when they got a little older, I started focusing a lot more on research. And now what's happening is I have time that they're all grown that I can do a lot more of the service that the university needs. And I feel like I like to do more of that service because for the younger faculty, they need to get their research done and they often have young families. And so I'm trying to step up a little more for that reason too, that just because depending on where you are in your life, sometimes you have more time, sometimes you have less time. And so now I feel like I have more time. So I'm very happy to contribute more. And I don't know if you're familiar with research, but that's the part where that can affect, and teaching also, but if you might have heard about the tenure process, but there's a process where you have a certain number of years to prove yourself here in research and in teaching. And so that's often that's early in your career. So once you prove yourself there, You can sort of go in and be a little more flexible. But before you get tenure, you really have to work a lot on research, and you have to make sure your teaching is good. And service is much less of something you have to worry about. And I feel like as you progress and become, as you go through the ranks as a professor, I feel like service should become more of something that you're doing, because the people younger in their careers maybe can't do it as much.
So how has the field of industrial organizational psychology developed over the last few decades?
I think it's started to focus a lot more on work as being an important part of somebody's life, as one's self-image, work as being linked to health, work as being linked to well-being, sort of more of a positive view of work. So I think across time, work has come to be viewed as really something that's very important, like that there's a pleasure in work, that if you have a job you love, it's a really good thing to be able to get up and go to work in the morning. But it's a shame that that's not true for everybody. So I think that's something, you know, a key part that I think in the field has changed, like more of a focus on that. And of course, technology. Technology has been huge, how it's impacted how we do our work, how we interact with each other. And also inclusiveness, that the idea that there are many different people with different experiences that come to work, and we have to figure out how they can all feel welcomed and feel that they belong. So I think those are the things I've really seen in the field across, and this is very slow change across time, but definitely, you know, work as being something that's important to your well-being, technology being incorporated into our work lives, and this idea of that we need to be as inclusive as we can.
Yeah, I'm taking a class in positive organizational scholarship right now, and the whole field, it's so interesting the way that positive psychology and IO are kind of getting married, and right, we're seeing, like you said, we spend so much of our time at work, it only makes sense that that becomes something that makes you a better person.
And you think about things like self-image, like so much of your self-image is tied up in your job. And even it goes on to like retirement. I think like, how do we help people retire? And what's a good age to retire? Because now, you know, it used to be people would retire at what, like 55, 60, you know, and then they would but people are living so long. So then it becomes, how do we sort of help people if they want to stay in the workplace, but maybe not stay in as intensely? Like, is there almost like a phase out plan?
Yeah.
And then even, do we help people like, what do you do in the morning if you don't get up and go to work? Like, what do you do to like fulfill yourself? And so I think those are questions that I think are going to be ones we're going to want to look at in the future for sure.
Definitely. How do we make these daily ins and outs more meaningful? How do we transition? Absolutely. So speaking of that, what are some other ways you think that IO psychology will develop in the next few decades?
Oh, that's a good question. So I do think there's the focus on, I think, aging, and I think that's going to be a big one. I do think there's going to be continued focus on inclusiveness and how do we, and I think a lot, I'm seeing this more too, like on creativity and innovation too. Like, how can we, in the workplace, what can we do to make things, you know, just to be able to free our minds and like think of new ideas and develop things.
No, I definitely agree. It does seem like our values in the workplace are, you know, those hard skills, things like that. I don't know if that's a technical term, but is one thing. But, you know, I had a friend who went to the career fair for, and he was talking to Amazon, and she said, do you want to know a secret? He was like, yeah. And she said, like, you know, what we really want at Amazon, this huge tech company, are people with these soft skills, you know? So, like you said, this new emphasis on creativity, people aren't just, you know, nose to the grindstone.
Yes. And I think the interesting thing is, I think those are exactly the things you get in a liberal arts education. So that's where I think CASEL students and students in the College of Arts, Sciences, and Letters, I think though you're getting some really good things like communication skills. Psychology students, I think, are getting like a great, and I've noticed that with psychology majors. I feel like things are, you know, people are really appreciating psychology majors these days. And I'm like, yay, go psychology.
How has studying psychology influenced how you view other people and the world?
I think what I've learned is that it's really important to listen to people. And so people have such interesting different perspectives. So my view is, if I want to actually make a difference or, you know, help motivate somebody, let's say I want to go in and try to motivate somebody in a work situation, the first thing I need to do is listen to them and figure out like what's going on with them and what would motivate them and what might be standing in their way and how they're feeling about it. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. And I don't think you can necessarily look at somebody and figure out like why they're doing what they're doing. But I think being a really good listener and knowing what questions to ask, I think that's really important. And I think that's true of like probably all psychologists. That's probably like a really common thing we have, right? It doesn't matter what our focus is. That idea of like trying to understand people, listening to them is probably key.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective on that. One that I don't think we've heard before, even asking this to all sorts of different psychologists. Thank you for your insight.
What's one piece of advice you would give to an undergraduate who wants to do what you do someday?
Oh, that's a good question. So I would first ask them what their goals are, because if somebody wants to get a PhD, that's really a research degree. So sometimes students will come to me and they're like, I want to get a PhD. And I'll say, do you want to do research? I hate research. And then I'm like, well, the thing about a PhD is it's very much setting you up to do research. So you really want to think about that. PhD programs are very competitive. So you would need to have a high GPA, high GRE scores. You'd want some research experience. So, and I'm not discouraged. I mean, if you have those things and you want to do research, please apply to PhD programs. Come talk to me, talk to other faculty. I think it's fantastic. But I want students to know, if you don't like research or if you don't feel that you have those qualifications, there are really good master's programs out there. And the one thing that's really nice about industrial psychology, the job market is great for people with master's degrees. You don't have to worry about, you don't have to get a PhD. And so that's sort of my point there, like a PhD is not required in the field. If you have one, though, it might allow you to move up to higher levels than if you have a master's only. But I would consider getting a master's degree in the field because it is much more attainable. It would get you on the job market faster. So that's just something to keep in mind.
What's some recommended reading that you have for people who are interested in the work that you do?
You know, I did not pick a book. So what I did was, I like to do, one thing I'm noticing, and this is in my own research also, because it's so applied, I get a ton of people who will talk about me, the study in a blog, or it'll get picked up by the press. So one thing, if you go to my faculty website, if you click on the link, there's a bunch of links where you can see articles about my articles. And so to me, like that's really, I like that sort of thing better. Like, so rather than me reading an entire book on one topic, because you know how I am, I told you I'm like flitting all over the place, right? So I like to do like the thing where I'll subscribe to something and then just get little snippets of research. And then I go, oh, look at that. And then if I like it, I'll click on it more. So for example, the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychologists, it's siop.org. I get a little news feed from, you know, a little summary from them every so often with research in the area. And one I saw recently, it made me laugh. It was something like, researchers are trying to show that looking at pictures of animals makes you more productive. And I love that because I spend like half my day looking at pictures of animals. So I was showing this to my husband. I'm like, look at this. I'm like such a suck. The only reason I ever go on Facebook, I'm like, I got to see the I don't know why. It's just like a weird thing, you know?
And that's a good question. Solid.
Okay, so I actually would go to, I mentioned before, the website, the SIOP, SIOP.org. I would go there because that really summarizes the field. And if you go there, you actually can see different grad programs. You can see what careers would be. You can look at, like, what kind of research is going on. So it's a really great summary of the field. And I like, since it's a website, it stays updated really well.
All right, Dr. Wong, that is all that we have for you. But thank you so much for your energy and all of your expertise about the field. We're so glad that we got to talk to you again and hear more specifically about the work that you do.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Thank you again, Dr. Wong, for coming on and talking to us about industrial organizational psychology.
Make sure to give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, so that you can stay up to date on our next interview. If you have a psychologist in mind who you think, oh my gosh, these guys have to talk to this person, feel free to send us an email at hosts@preoccupied.com.
Give us a visit at our website at preoccupied.com. Don't forget the hyphen. And feel free to shoot us an email just if you want to chat as well, because we're always looking to connect with our audience.
So that's it till next time. Thank you for tuning in to Preoccupied. oh my gosh, he just got neutered. So he's at home with a little cone around his head.